I'm George Herman reporting on the CBS Radio Network. It was the morning after his acceptance speech, and Jimmy Carter of Georgia went before the Democratic National Committee in New York City, making it clear he hadn't lost a drop from his well-stocked reservoir of confidence.
My strategy for the fall is to run flat out. I don't intend to lose a state. I'm going to work just as hard. I'm going to get up just as early. I'm going to work just as late at night in October and in September as I did in February and March.
Jimmy Carter stepped to the microphone at a $100 a plate breakfast for the Democratic National Committee, and he laid out his campaign plans in precise, unmistakable terms.
I think we'll win in the fall. The polls look good everywhere. We polled in California, in New York, in Ohio, in Indiana, Michigan, as separate states already. Things look good there. I even have a good chance to win in California against Reagan and Michigan against Ford.
The candidate, of course, has always been a confident campaigner. Way back in the early days of the primary trail, he was telling audiences he fully intended and expected to win. But today he warned the leading members of his party that the election was far from a sure thing.
The one fatal mistake that the Democrats can make is overconfidence. I ran a hard, tough, constant campaign. My wife, Rosen, my son, Jeffrey, my son, Chip, my son, Jack, their wives, my aunt, Sissy. This year, with an increasing number of volunteers, I'm not going to take anything for granted.
And to make sure that his influential audience of Democrats understood, Carter made a pitch for campaign funds. He said he would run a, quote, penurious operation with $22 million in federal matching money as his base. And this plea for money, he said, would be one of his last.
I don't want to have to waste my time, or Mondale's time, or Strauss's time, begging you to help. I'm begging you now. And I expect that you will respond, knowing the quality of people whom you are, and your interest in our party and in our nation. I'll try to do a good job. I'll try not to disappoint you as a candidate. And I expect, with a great deal of confidence, that you won't disappoint me.
Jimmy Carter went home to Plains, Georgia today. His running mate, Walter Mondale, went back to Washington. The campaign, Carter made clear, may not wait until the traditional Labor Day start. Campaign 76, I'm George Herman, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Gary Shepard reporting on the CBS Radio Network. The Democrats have left New York and the Republicans are pulling out their roadmaps for Kansas City. Most of the political attention this week was centered on the Democrats in convention. The men they nominated, Jimmy Carter and Walter Mondale, are today making plans for the fall campaign. But for Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan, the only plans they can make with certainty deal not with September and October, but with the GOP convention in Kansas City next month. The two men are still virtually tied in their race for Republican delegates. Mr. Ford has a slight lead and should increase it a bit by the end of the weekend after the Connecticut delegation is selected. The president went to Hartford today to make a pitch for those delegates, most of whom are expected to go to his camp anyway. The fact that he's going at all, however, underscores the closeness of his race with Reagan. For both men, the coming 3 weeks will mean more talking to uncommitted delegates, more hunting for even a single supporter in Kansas City. And it seems clear that Reagan has the tougher battle ahead. Publicly, the former California governor is optimistic. "We are on schedule," he said in Pennsylvania the other day. "I feel good. I feel we're going to make it." But for Reagan, the political numbers are not so rosy. The uncommitted delegates, both he and Mr. Ford seek, are staying uncommitted. The leaning delegates are staying that way. No unleaning, as one GOP politician called it. In Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Reagan spent the entire afternoon with one group of delegates after another. Nobody emerged afterward saying he or she was now a Reagan supporter. Reagan's other problem, according to the people who get paid to watch politicians, is simply one of clout. It takes a strong, uncommitted delegate not to bend when the presidential treatment is pressed in full gear. Luncheon at the White House, phone calls from the president, pictures in the Oval Office. Reagan can only counter with his rhetoric and by autographing old movie posters. By Monday morning, all of the delegates that can be chosen to the August convention in Kansas City will have been chosen. That leaves 3 weeks until the opening gavel, and unquestionably the most important 3 weeks in the political lives of both Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan. Campaign 76. I'm Gary Shepard, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm George Herman, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. With me are political consultant Neil Pierce, who has interviewed Jimmy Carter at some length on his approach to the presidency. Neil, I suppose the first question is, what are the basic qualities of character, of leadership and style of this man of whom we know so little?
Well, he is a complex character in many ways. I see sort of three major strands in the Carter personality. One is the incredibly ambitious, sometimes coldly calculatingly ambitious man who believes that he can accomplish a great deal, who is not frightened of anything, and has made his way, as we have noted, to the Democratic nomination against all political odds. The second factor in the Carter personality you might call his management side. He went to Annapolis, the Naval Academy, and then he's become they give him a sort of a scientific engineering orientation.
They also teach decision.
Yes, that's right. And he has become, he's bugged up on the question of management, good executive management. And he believes that through management and through planning, you can achieve a great deal, that it's not necessary to just let government float along, that government can undertake great plans. So there's the management executive side to him. Finally, there is a side which I think is legitimately, you could call it his compassion side, certainly his social justice side. Perhaps this comes out of the religious background. Perhaps it comes out of being a South Georgia populist, if you will, in a non-racist sense. But I've found, again and again, looking through his public record and also talking to him, examples in which it certainly seemed that you were dealing with a person who had a true compassion for people in certain instances and an interest in seeing government services delivered to them more efficiently. There's a tie between the compassion and the management side. His interest in people and helping them ties into how he thinks government should be managed for more effective delivery of services for people.
Like plenty of other people who are interested in management, one detects occasionally a little bit of stubbornness in the man.
He is one of the most stubborn people you've ever met. It's incredible.
Even when he's wrong?
Well, he thinks he's right. Now, that gets us into how he makes a decision. He has a very clear decision-making model, and he says it comes somewhat out of his scientific and engineering background. He likes to get a lot of inputs. He talks to all sorts of people, different ideological backgrounds and so on. He reads omnivorously. When he isn't campaigning, he claims he reads 4 or 5 books a week. But facing a complex subject, he'll read very broadly in it. He'll talk to a great many people. And then after he has completed that process and a lot of discussions in person, he then will make up his mind alone. He is not a person who sits around with the boys and thrashes out a decision. Once that decision is made, both as to the policy and the way you're going to implement it, the strategy, then he is extremely stubborn, and he takes heaven and earth to move him. Now, I asked him about this because it's a well-known part of his character. Couldn't this get you into a situation like Woodrow Wilson with the League of Nations, where you become so brittle and stubborn that, you know, you lose the whole show? He claims not. He went through a number of things that he'd done in Georgia, and he said he couldn't recall an instance in which his own stubbornness had defeated a good cause. And I checked, and I couldn't find any where he really could have won a great deal if he'd been willing to compromise at some point. But he's a very tough fighter for what he wants and will not compromise until the last minute. And that could cause some real sparks in the Washington, D.C. setting.
Thank you very much. This is Campaign 76 with syndicated columnist Neil Pierce and George Herman, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Douglas Edwards, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. One of the few surprises to come out of the Democratic National Convention was a draft evader, Fritz Efaw, whose name was placed in nomination for the vice presidency. Fritz Efaw spent 7 years as an exile in England, avoiding the United States Selective Service System. Several months ago, he was elected as a delegate to the Democratic Convention, representing Americans abroad. Last week, Fritz Efaw returned home to state an issue.
What I'm most concerned about right now is that I think there's a danger that Governor Carter would become president and then proclaim a bad amnesty, when he'd be stuck with it for the next 4 or 8 years, in the same way that President Ford is stuck with a position that's untenable now.
Fritz Ifar returned through the help of the National Council for Universal and Unconditional Amnesty, a group that had been speaking with Jimmy Carter's issue makers, trying to formulate a broader amnesty plank. But the council's president, Irma Zegas, feels that Carter's view is still too narrow.
Before the convention, Mr. Eisenstadt said that Mr. Carter was not bound to the platform. He was only going to be running on the issue of pardon for draft evaders, and that the Democratic platform, which calls for a full pardon for those who are in legal and financial jeopardy, was the Democratic platform, and that Carter was not bound to run on that.
Fritz Ifar and others felt that the only way to bring the amnesty issue before the convention was to have the issue addressed from the podium. They realized that would not happen, and so last Thursday, Fritz Ifar was nominated as a vice presidential candidate. He would be given time before the convention, but he would not run. Ifar declined the nomination and said he wanted no further recognition from the convention, but he told a CBS News producer that that does not mean he will stop campaigning for general amnesty.
I see it, what I was doing at the convention and what I'm doing now as being a kind of stalking horse to go out, take a position which is goes beyond the position on amnesty and the platform, let Governor Carter see from the response to me what the response to a broader amnesty will be, and hope that takes a position closer to what I'm advocating.
For now, Fritz Ifar has other obligations.
I have to report for a court hearing in Oklahoma next Monday morning. I'm not sure how that's going to turn out, but I'm quite confident that in the long run we'll prevail in the courts.
The National Council for Amnesty does not plan a similar move at the Republican convention. The goal now, they say, is to confront Jimmy Carter and to make themselves heard. Campaign 76. I'm Douglas Edwards, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm George Herman, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. With me are political consultant Neil Pierce, who's interviewed Jimmy Carter at some length on his approach to the presidency. And I guess one of the questions that has to be asked in this day and age, Neil, is the imperial presidency. Is Jimmy Carter a kind of man who will fit into the concept of an imperial presidency?
Well, he knows the dangers. I guess he also knows that anybody who gets into that office has terrific temptations to become sort of an imperial president, have a palace guard about you, not let any outside no-saying voices come in, and then get off on wild tangents, which is what has happened to the imperial presidency in recent years.
You mean like those comic opera costumes that Richard Nixon put on his buglers?
Yeah, exactly. Matter of fact, I asked him a question on pomp and circumstance and booming 21-gun salutes and so on, and he said that he intended to reduce the pomp and circumstance of the presidency, and he thought the American people would appreciate that. But on the broader question of a president becoming so overblown in his own mind as to his own capacity, the arrogance of it, he said he was aware of it, and he suggested that he had two major ways to prevent it. One was sort of a new openness in the presidency, or at least an increased openness. He said he was going to have press conferences regularly. He pledged at least every 2 weeks or 20 times a year at a minimum.
He won't be the first president who promises that ahead of time and finds he's a little too busy to do it.
Well, I don't know whether he's going to keep his promises. All I can say is what the promises are. They're interesting. He wants to go back to the fireside chat format. He even suggested that if he could arrange it, he'd like to have a citizens visiting hour at the White House like he did when he was governor of Georgia, though security problems probably make that impossible. But his inclination, strong inclination, and he says his pledge, is to have a very open presidency. The second is to allow free-ranging debate within the cabinet and within his own personal staff, where people dare to say no. Well, I said people have said that before, and George Reedy, for instance, points out, has written an excellent book on the presidency, that the awe-inspiring atmosphere of the White House makes that impossible. And he said, yes, I've read Reedy's book, and I'm aware of that. All he says I can say, he said, is that I'm going to try to prevent it. So what I found interesting was that he had gone mentally through this problem. Whether, in fact, he can avoid being an imperial president, we just don't know.
What kind of a cabinet do you think he'll choose?
Again, he says all the good textbook things these days. He says he's going to have a very outstanding cabinet. He's going to get very independent people in it. He's going to govern directly through the cabinet rather than through a White House staff, which you also have heard before. The only reason that I think there's some more chance he might pull it off is that he has been an executive. He was a governor of a pretty good-sized state. And while the scale of that, of course, is much smaller than the scale of the federal executive establishment, he has experience, and he'd be the first person with any real executive experience moving into the presidency in a couple of decades.
But, of course, when you have a free and independent cabinet, the cabinet members become sort of the spokesman for their departments rather than for the administration.
Again, this incredible Carter optimism, I asked him about that problem, and he said, well, I realize they become advocates for special interest that's mm-hmm. represented by their department, but I expect to have a well enough thought out overall budget and plan of action for the administration so that while I welcome dissent, we'll be within the context of agreed upon overall plan.
But dissent has to stop, finally, when the president says this is the policy.
Obviously, yes.
Okay, thank you very much. This has been Campaign 76. Our guest has been syndicated columnist and CBS News political consultant Neil Pierce. And I'm George Herman, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Phil Jones, CBS News White House correspondent, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. Ronald Reagan's campaign aides say they already have 10 more delegates than needed for a first ballot Reagan nomination. The Ford camp says baloney to that Reagan claim. This report involves lots of confusing statistics and claims that are coming from the President Ford and Ronald Reagan campaign organizations. The numbers game goes like this. Reagan's people say they have 1140 delegates or 10 more than needed for nomination. The Ford counters are up to 1120 for their man. That is 10 short of what they need for victory. But the Ford people say they are not blowing smoke like the Reagan folks are. Now, to further confuse you, we introduce a third set of figures. The CBS News delegate count, which indicates that neither man has the Republican nomination locked up at this point. The CBS News count, Ford 1109, Reagan 1062, or 47 behind Mr. Ford, and 88 delegates are still undetermined. What's going on? Well, no one but the 2,259 Republican delegates really know at this point. The Reagan counters have suggested that one factor is that some of the delegates are just not telling the truth about how they will finally vote once they get to Kansas City next month. The Reagan campaign aides claim there are 40 to 50 delegates who have been saying they will vote for Mr. Ford, but that they are in effect lying, that they really plan to vote for Reagan. What appears to be happening is that both sides have now reached this point close to convention time without having enough committed delegates for victory. So now it is nothing more than psychological warfare. Both men trying to look like winners. Both men, in effect, blowing smoke, trying to impress the uncommitted delegates. But unless things change soon, Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan are not really going to know what's happening until the real delegate counting begins with the convention roll call for ballot number one at the Kansas City Convention. Campaign 76. I'm Phil Jones, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Doug Poling, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. A look at environmentalists, politicians, and the Dirty Dozen campaign after this. Since 1970, a Washington lobby known as Environmental Action has been influencing congressional, gubernatorial, and local elections. Their goal is to make the environment an important campaign issue and to unseat any incumbent who doesn't meet up to their standards. Each year, they issue a Dirty Dozen list of the 12 worst offenders. And this year, they are actively campaigning against the dozen in their home districts. The campaign's director is Dennis Bass.
Well, when someone gets named to the Dirty Dozen, it's an indication that they are not going to change their views on environmental issues. And so our goal is no longer to change their votes, but to defeat them in either the primary or the general elections.
This year, the Dirty Dozen campaign's number one target is Representative John Rhodes of Arizona.
Well, Mr. Rhodes, of course, is the House Minority Leader and, as such, is in a very powerful position to do good or harm against environmental legislation. And he has used his position to gut and to harm important environmental legislation over the years.
John Rhodes had tough campaigns in 1972 and 1974. He is a Republican in a predominantly Democratic district, and his opponents have made a point of attacking his environmental record. 1976 should be another tough campaign, but Rhodes isn't taking the Dirty Dozen list quietly. He questions Environmental Action's nonpartisanship, saying that what they really seem to be doing is attempting to unseat conservative members of Congress.
his press assistant says the Dirty Dozen nomination is based upon 14 votes Rhodes took part in, and not a long series of environmental offenses as the list implies. Besides, he says, there are others in Washington whose records are the same, if not worse. Rhodes has called the Dirty Dozen campaign a phony organization engaged in questionable campaign tactics. He means to check them out and to confront them whenever possible. Still, the Dirty Dozen campaigners continue with their hit-them-at-home tactics. We have to push politicians, Dennis Bass says, to recognize the important issues. Campaign 76. I'm Doug Poling, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Sam Chulin, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. The first announcement from Ronald Reagan's campaign staff this morning was to expect a major political statement today. Later that phrase changed to become an historic political announcement. Everyone but the principals involved were in the dark until Ronald Reagan spoke to the press in Los Angeles.
Since I now feel that the people and the delegates have a right to know in advance of the convention who a nominee's vice presidential choice would be, I am today departing from tradition and announcing my selection. I have chosen the distinguished United States Senator from Pennsylvania, the Honorable Richard Schweiker. I'm convinced that this is a ticket behind which all Republicans can unite and which will lead our party to victory in November.
The news was a bombshell coming 3 weeks before the Republican convention, 3 weeks before all of the uncommitted delegates would finally have to make their choices between President Ford and Ronald Reagan. Richard Schweiker, as Reagan's running mate, now makes that choice easier for some and more difficult for others. Schweiker is a northerner. He's a senator with a reputation as a moderate, contrasting with Reagan's conservative views. After Reagan made his announcement, Richard Schweiker held a news conference in Washington, stressing the point that now there's a coalition of conservative and moderate Republicans. His key words, unity and victory.
Governor Reagan's decisive stroke, in one fell swoop, unites the Republican Party for November by bringing together the conservative and moderate wings of our party. It instantly gives our party across-the-board appeal.
Of course, neither Ronald Reagan nor Richard Schweiker have been nominated by their party. And while they both talk about winning in November, they're also talking about winning in August. Schweiker said that there was never any talk of delegates when he spoke with Reagan's campaign staff. But that fact cannot be overlooked. The Republican nominating process has emerged to become a one-on-one campaign with both candidates actively seeking individual delegate votes. President Ford has maintained a narrow margin over Ronald Reagan, but it is too narrow for anyone to be competent enough to predict a definite first ballot nomination. The decision could be left to a handful of delegates with enough votes to swing the nomination in either candidate's favor. Pennsylvania may have those votes. As of this morning, Pennsylvania's uncommitted delegates favored President Ford, but now that could change. Richard Schweiker is a native son who controls the way many delegates think, and he admitted that today's event would throw the delegation into chaos. His first act of this new assignment, said Schweiker, was to personally call each member.
I'll be making a lot of telephone calls today. I know for a fact that there were a lot of people in our delegation who frankly preferred Governor Reagan but had two concerns. One was it wasn't quite the thing to do in my state to be for him, and that little peer group situation prevailed. And number two, they weren't quite sure that it would really help the ticket in November. And we solved both problems instantly, so I frankly think this is going to unleash some very fundamental Reagan support in my state. And number two, it's going to get some Ford delegates who happen to like Dick Schweiker to figure that maybe he'd make a good VP and convert him.
If Richard Schweiker succeeds in winning Pennsylvania for Reagan, and if the Reagan-Schweiker conservative moderate coalition succeeds in turning other delegates' heads, President Ford's narrow margin may shrink to no margin. For now, the attention is on the delegates who must weigh Ronald Reagan's choice and then make their own choice when the Republicans convene in Kansas City. This has been Campaign 76. I'm Sam Chulin, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Douglas Edwards, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. People have been saying that this year the Republicans are acting more and more like the Democrats, or at least the way the Democrats were acting in 1972. 4 years ago, there was an open conflict in the Democratic Party between the Humphrey Regulars and the McGovern Reformers. By contrast, the Republican convention 4 years ago was predetermined. Everything went along much the same as it did for the Democrats this year.
Of course, the Democrats did have their share of suspense during the primary campaign. There were charges thrown back and forth between the candidates, but now it's the Republicans' turn. Ronald Reagan's unprecedented announcement of Richard Schweiker as his running mate 3 weeks before the convention may only add fuel to the fire. The plan, as it's outlined by the candidates, is to form a coalition of conservatives and moderates within the Republican Party, a coalition that both Reagan and Schweiker feel will win in August and in November. But is the coalition too broad? Some delegates who favor Reagan are beginning to doubt the idea. Some potential voters for Reagan in November may feel the same way, that Richard Schweiker is too far to the left of Ronald Reagan to warrant their support. The AFL-CIO Committee on Political Education likes him so much, in fact, that they gave him a 100% rating. Conservatives, on the other hand, give him very low ratings. Ronald Reagan has often spoken about the importance of America's military strength. Richard Schweiker was one of the few Republicans to vote against Richard Nixon's anti-ballistic missile program. Richard Schweiker says that he and Ronald Reagan do not agree on everything, but that they do agree on the same general issues. Obviously, they both agree that this coalition will work itself out of any issue struggles and that the main concern right now is the political struggle. Schweiker has a certain amount of influence over Pennsylvania's uncommitted delegates, delegates that Ronald Reagan may need to win in Kansas City. President Ford's campaign manager, Rogers Morton, says that seems to be what Ronald Reagan is after, the delegates, and Richard Schweiker is a way to get them. Right now, Schweiker means to contact the members of the delegation to convert them from President Ford to Ronald Reagan, he says. No doubt Ford campaigners are out trying to retain the margin they have. Mr. Ford is personally visiting Mississippi and talking to uncommitted delegates there on Friday. Some conservative delegates are worried that the Reagan-Schweiker coalition might compromise the issues that Ronald Reagan stands for in his campaign. No doubt Reagan campaigners are out to settle their fears. And so we have two candidates looking for a nomination. Several factions of delegates, conservatives, moderates, and liberals, arguing among themselves and with each other. We have a new idea bucking an incumbent president. And we have a convention in 3 weeks where all of these groups will meet and no one will know the outcome until the roll call of the states. Much the same as the Democrats in 72. Campaign 76. I'm Douglas Edwards, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Eric Engberg, CBS News, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. Richard Schweiker's first job as a vice presidential candidate was to try to win for Ronald Reagan the votes of delegates in his home state of Pennsylvania. A report on how Schweiker's doing. Schweiker has spent almost all of his time as a candidate on the phone back to Pennsylvania, trying to convince at least some of the state's 103 delegates, most of them uncommitted or for President Ford, that they should turn now to Reagan. He claims six have jumped already. The president's backers have been watching all this closely and with no small amount of concern, and have been making a few phone calls of their own to delegates. And the Ford backers say they count almost 90 votes still solid for the president. Most of the delegate watching has been done by Drew Lewis, the president's chairman for Pennsylvania. Schweiker's embrace by Reagan posed particular problems for Lewis because he is Schweiker's next-door neighbor and has been his campaign manager in the last four elections. But Lewis remains solidly behind the president.
The sole purpose of this move was to get delegates in the Northeast, and that is simply it. And Schweiker was a vehicle to hopefully get delegates.
And I don't believe it's going to work.
It is the hope of Lewis and the other Ford workers that liberals and moderates will regard the selection of Schweiker as an act of opportunism and thus be unimpressed with it, and that conservatives will regard it as an act of ideological heresy. But Reagan's Pennsylvania chairman, Gordon Hoffman, says,
"We're going to pick up as many as another 15 delegates.
Are you worried that some of your conservative supporters will defect?"
"Yes, I think there will be some, and I honor their opinions. However, I don't think it's going to be that many. I think as few as four or five, maybe six."
And you're hoping to offset that by pickups on the liberal side of the scale?
No question about it. At this point, I do feel that we will have an opportunity to pick up those additional delegates.
One tactic being planned by the Reagan camp to hold conservatives in line is the claim that Schweiker is not really as much of a liberal as he's been billed.
The argument will be based on such things as Schweiker's long record of criticism of detente and opposition of gun control. Campaign 76. I'm Eric Engberg, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Bernard Goldberg in Jackson, Mississippi, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. Ronald Reagan's decision to name liberal Senator Richard Schweiker as his prospective running mate has not gone over well in conservative Mississippi, a state with 30 still officially uncommitted delegate votes, a state that may decide in this close contest who the Republican presidential nominee is. Clark Reed is Mississippi's Republican chairman. He is a political veteran and one of the most influential Republicans in the South. Clark Reed was a Reagan backer. Today, he is a Ford backer. Reed joined the Ford team as a result, he said, of Ronald Reagan's decision to name Senator Schweiker as a potential running mate. Reed said he is against a philosophically split ticket. He said Schweiker's views are well to the left of the American mainstream. I am very in tune with Governor Reagan's record, Reed said, but I believe having this kind of vice president, Schweiker, is too big a price to pay for the nomination. Reed's decision presents a serious blow to Reagan's chances of winning Mississippi's 30 votes. Mississippi has a so-called unit rule, which binds all 30 votes to the candidate with a majority of support in the state delegation. And it is believed that Clark Reed's decision to switch from Reagan to Ford may sway other Mississippi delegates to do the same, possibly giving candidate Ford all 30 Mississippi votes. The Schweiker decision did not sit well in Mississippi from the start. Reagan's Mississippi campaign manager, W.D. Billy Munger, said he was very unhappy with the choice and added there's no way the decision to name a liberal like Schweiker will help Ronald Reagan in the South. But Munger also added he is still backing the California governor. Gerald Ford is to meet with the Mississippi delegation in Jackson tomorrow, and Ronald Reagan, who met the delegates last month, will meet them again next Wednesday in Jackson. He will bring Senator Schweiker with him in an effort to convince the Mississippi delegates that they, Reagan and Schweiker, are philosophically more in tune than is widely believed. But a Ford man in Mississippi was skeptical. If Reagan can convince the Mississippi delegation that he and Schweiker are philosophically in tune, he said, it will go down in history as one of the greatest selling jobs since we bought Manhattan from the Indians. Campaign 76, I'm Bernard Goldberg, CBS News.
Campaign 76, I'm Jim McManus, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. The contest for the Republican presidential nomination has moved from the grand-scale conflicts of the primaries and state conventions to a kind of guerrilla warfare. In the continuing struggle to prove that each already has won the Republican nomination, President Ford and Ronald Reagan send their patrols into the political jungles and later issue communiques listing delegates captured, all to no one's total satisfaction. Although each side claims victory, neither is willing to retire from the field, explaining that they want the safety of excess numbers for the long march to Kansas City. Having claimed sufficiency, the problem now facing the combatants is credibility. And that requires names, not numbers. The latest list of delegates comes from the Reagan camp, where campaign manager John Sears began the process of filling in the blanks to back up the Reagan claim of 1,140 delegates, 10 more than needed for the nomination. Sears divulged 12 names, admitting he's been counting five of them for Reagan for some time now. He claimed five Pennsylvania switches from the Ford column and one each in New York State and West Virginia. Not surprisingly, the White House contested the claim and reasserted that President Ford already is over the top with 1,135. Proving that there are as many counts as there are counters, the CBS News survey indicates the latest claim may add five, but not seven, to the Reagan total. This claim and counterclaim strategy is psychological warfare. Having named liberal Pennsylvania Senator Richard Schweiker as his running mate, Ronald Reagan would now like President Ford to do the same. The aim in this is to pry loose some Ford supporters who just might be upset at the Ford choice. John Sears says many delegates want to know.
I think that you will find as the remaining 2 weeks go by between now and the Republican convention that Mr. Ford will find himself in a position where it is not possible for him to sit by and not answer the pressing question that now is before him, and that namely is who he would choose as a running mate if he were nominated.
Both sides promise more of this sort of thing during the next 2 weeks. Campaign 76. I'm Jim McManus, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Gary Shepard reporting on the CBS Radio Network.
While public attention is focused on the National Republican Party candidates, local campaigns, usual and unusual, go on. A lot of people may not realize that even though the second major convention of this political year is just 2 weeks away, many candidates are still involved in primary campaigns for the Senate, Congress, and governorships. It is a crowded field and, in some cases, a tough political battle. Four states are holding primary elections today: Missouri, Michigan, Kansas, and Idaho. More will follow in the coming weeks. But from those four states alone, there are enough candidates to fill a small state house. In Michigan, for example, eight candidates, four from each party, are seeking Senate nominations. The Missouri battlefield is crowded with 11 Democrats, hoping to win Senator Stuart Symington's seat. There, the campaign has actually narrowed to two congressmen, Jerry Litton and James Symington, the latter vying for the seat his father has held for 24 years. Neither candidate is taking the campaign lightly. Litton's effort cost nearly $1 million. He managed to narrow the margin against Symington in the opinion polls, but as voters went to make their choices this morning, the race was still being described as a dead heat. Arizona politics is as rough as Missouri politics is expensive. The fight for the Republican Senate nomination may turn out to be the roughest of this campaign year. To add to the expected political rivalry, the two candidates, Sam Steiger and John Conlon, also happen to be personal enemies. Many Arizona Republicans fear that the two will go at each other so viciously, in fact, that the Democrats stand a good chance of winning the general election in November. The two candidates are both congressmen with similar political philosophies. But because they seem to hate each other so much, voters have heard Sam Steiger call John Conlon a plastic politician. Then they've heard Conlon say Steiger couldn't win with the many skeletons and scandals the Democrats would throw at him. The battle will continue. Arizona's primary date is not until September the 7th. Meanwhile, of course, Jimmy Carter is campaigning, and the Kansas City-bound Republicans are working over their delegate counts, adding, subtracting, waiting for that one delegation which will put their candidate over the top. All in all, this Campaign 76, with its legions of candidates and political feuds, probably is politics as usual. After all, it was just yesterday that Harold Stassen announced he would actively campaign for the presidential nomination at the Republican convention. Confident, he says, that if nominated, he could unite the party and lead it to victory. Campaign 76. I'm Gary Shepard, CBS News.
Campaign 76. I'm Bruce Hall, reporting on the CBS Radio Network. Jimmy Carter has made a major departure from his earlier theme of national conciliation. Jimmy Carter surprised most observers with his strongest attack of the campaign on President Ford during a two-day campaign tour of New Hampshire and Washington. It was a marked change from his earlier theme of unity, which he had used to gain the Democratic nomination. Since the convention, he has been resting at home in Plains, Georgia, keeping a generally low profile. But aides say the former Georgia governor was getting restless at home and was anxious to get back on the campaign trail. But due to tradition, he felt he could not begin his official campaign until Labor Day. So he decided to make the most of a few scheduled appearances before the start of the campaign. Aides said Carter made the strong attack on the president in order to avoid the image of complacency, that of an overconfident front-runner. Carter is known to be concerned about national opinion polls that show him with an almost 2-to-1 lead. The strong attacks on President Ford were designed to keep his supporters on their toes and to keep his name in the news as we approach the Republican convention. Carter's prediction of an almost unprecedented vicious personal attack by the Republicans is being taken as an attempt to take the wind out of any charges from a reunited Republican Party after the convention. Carter is trying to stay one step ahead of the opposition. Reporters traveling with Carter find it difficult to distinguish between the attacks by the Democratic nominee on President Ford and those which Carter says the Republicans will make against him. But Carter says it is simple. He is attacking the policies of the Ford administration, not President Ford as an individual. Carter's official campaign will begin on Labor Day, but when he makes one or two campaign forays this month, aides say that you can expect some major addresses and a few hard-hitting speeches. The campaign theme of national unity and conciliation will return, but it may not be until after Labor Day. That campaign is now being planned in Atlanta and Plains. Carter aides say that he is trying to hold expenditures to $21 million for the campaign. That is one quarter of what President Nixon spent 4 years ago,
and the lowest of any campaign in the past 16 years. Campaign 76. I'm Bruce Hall, reporting on the CBS Radio Network.